Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work. Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
And they said to the head teacher, you know, are there any concerns about this child? And of course, instantly this planted a seed. The teacher then followed up with an email and said, this is of potential concern. And they noted this particular incident where the child was saying, you know, Allah created everything. Allah created snow. My mum taught me this Arabic prayer, dua. And they said, you know, this could be of concern. And they shared that.
The British Conservative government is currently going through crisis after crisis. For the past 12 years, we have witnessed the slow and sorry car crash of its failed policies. At the time of broadcast, its current embattled Prime Minister, Liz Truss, has had to U-turn on her economic plan and hangs on by a thread. Yet very few journalists and political commentators pay much attention to another series of disastrous policy initiatives focused on the Muslim community. And despite all the evidence, the government ploughs money into initiatives like Prevent, an insidious counter-terror strategy that has caused untold damage to community relations and alienated large numbers of Muslims. Prevent, a statutory duty of all public officials, looks to find what the government calls signs of radicalization. Often these indicators are conflated with Islamic practice or subject to the prejudices of teachers and other officials that have been whipped up in a McCarthyite-style frenzy. My guest today is an academic and activist who has been following the trail of mayhem caused by Prevent and has for years held the government to account. Dr. Leila Eitel-Haj is the director of Prevent Watch. Her most recent contribution as the co-author of the People's Review of Prevent drew support from over a dozen human rights NGOs, including Amnesty International and the UN Rapporteur on Protecting Freedoms. I asked Dr. Leila to help us understand Prevent, analyse the broader implications of the policy, and draw on her extensive casework to help us visualise why Prevent and the Conservative Party is toxic within our communities. So Dr. Leila Eitel-Haj, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and thank you for joining us at the Thinking Muslim podcast.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me on.
Now, it's really a pleasure to have you with us, because I know you're an expert when it comes to Prevent and its interrelated issues. And there's a lot of moving parts that I want to explore today. And I know that you'd be able to untangle this for us. I mean, you've been one of the most prominent campaigners against Prevent. Your organization, Prevent Watch, launched an independent review of Prevent earlier this year as a response to the government's long-awaited review, known as the Shawcross Review. I want to explore your review and your criticisms of Shawcross and the broader government strategy. Listeners to this podcast would know that we've looked at it at previously, at least, Prevent and its interrelated issues. We've explored the Trojan horse affair, but I know your expertise will fill many of the gaps that I have in my thinking about where the government is going with this strategy. But let's start with Prevent as a policy. Now, my understanding is it began with the Labour government in 2007 and consequently has been expanded by the Conservative government and made a statutory duty. Talk me through what Prevent is, how it works, and what it aims to achieve, and I suppose how it's been extended and expanded over the years.
Prevent is one arm of four arms of the UK's counterterrorism strategy. So there is protect, prepare, pursue, and prevent. And Prevent is unique from the other aspects of the counterterrorism strategy because it acts clearly within the pre-crime space. Now, when people think pre-crime, they think, oh, that's great because it's just before a crime, because the word pre-crime. But actually, what we're talking about in pre-crime is something well before any intention or preparation has ever occurred. We're not talking about pre-crime in the way that you might just dissect the word and say it's before a crime. No, in fact, pursue is looking at something before the crime. Pursue is disrupting an activity before it happens. So when media or government suggests that, oh, we've unfoiled terror attacks, you couldn't have possibly unfoiled them using Prevent. What you've actually unfoiled is something that was in preparation, and therefore what they've used is they've used pursue. Prevent can never be demonstrated as being used to stop a terror attack because Prevent is based on thoughts and ideas. And this is why you hear about people being referred to Prevent as 4-year-olds or 10-year-olds. They've never intended or thought about committing any crime, let alone a terrorist activity. So what it is it's based on the idea that you can stop people from becoming future terrorists. Okay, so it's essentially, if somebody told you that, oh, I can predict your future, you would probably laugh them out the room. And yet the government is telling us that they can predict who might be vulnerable later on in the future to become a terrorist. And somehow that is accepted, and millions of pounds are injected into Prevent every single year to keep this going, despite the fact that there's been no evidence to suggest that this can actually work.
Let me understand this. So, I don't know, a 16-year-old boy at school is preparing to, I mean, as we saw the phenomenon a few years back, 5 or 6 years back, preparing to travel to Syria. Would that be a typical example of a Prevent referral?
It would be. So usually if a teacher has heard, okay, this child is going to travel, then they probably would refer it under Prevent, but they wouldn't, it wouldn't just be a case that, oh, you know, this child might go and travel to Syria and therefore I'm going to refer them under Prevent, right? It would be any child traveling anywhere abroad, particularly to a Muslim country, might get flagged under Prevent. And furthermore, if you were going to actually, if you did think as a teacher, this child is about to go and travel to Syria, then you wouldn't actually draw on Prevent. It would be more of an immediate action. You would probably call the police if you thought that he was traveling to Syria to join a group, right? You wouldn't call on Prevent, because Prevent is like seen as the softer approach. You would call the police and say, look, I think he's going to travel abroad, and I think he's going to, you know, so there's a very clear distinction. They wouldn't say to that person, oh, you know, we think you're vulnerable and therefore you're going to come under Prevent. It would be very, very early on. So they might actually not say, well, I'm preparing to go and travel abroad, the Prevent referral would be more in the category of, this child knows a lot about Syria. They spend a lot of time online. I'm worried that they might go and think about traveling to Syria, rather than I know they're in the act of preparing to go to Syria.
Right. Okay. And so I think something like half of all referrals are made by school teachers. And so what we're talking about primarily, or at least, you know, in a greater sense, young people who are being referred to the Prevent scheme. So school teachers would typically be looking out for signs of radicalization, or what they have been trained to believe is radicalization. I mean, give me some examples of things that school teachers will be looking out for in a student.
Yeah, so the signs of radicalization are the signs that teachers, you know, doctors, any public sector worker would have been trained upon. And these signs are really general signs that essentially any single teenager and even any adult could have been referred under. It doesn't take a particular combination of these signs, and these signs are as general as, you know, looking for identity and meaning, you know, showing dominance, going through a transitional period. Every single person is going to tick their teenage child. And this is why a lot of the referrals are actually from, towards teenagers. The Prevent referrals are of teenagers because they're going through these natural transitions. Of course, they're going to be a bit more withdrawn or change their friendship groups or, you know, potentially change their religion. These things happen. It's a normal part of growing up. It's a normal part of changing your ideas. And yet these are the same signs that people have no idea about terrorism are told, you know, you need to look out for these signs because that person could be vulnerable to becoming a future terrorist, essentially. And this is where a lot of the conflation comes in. And, you know, just going back to that point about Syria, I mean, schools already knew about Prevent when the Bethnal Green girls went and traveled to Syria. Yes. You know, they weren't stopped. They weren't stopped from traveling under Prevent. In fact, I believe one of their schools was one of the first ones to adopt Prevent in the first place. But they didn't, you know, they didn't get stopped from traveling to Syria. And so it begs the question, why are people who do end up traveling to Syria, why are they not stopped by Prevent?
And why is that? I mean, you tell me.
Well, simply because Prevent doesn't work. I mean, you're screening, if you think of how many public sector workers there are in the UK, there are over 5 million public sector workers. And so essentially what you're doing is you're getting 5 million public sector workers to be your eyes and ears and to report on anything that they feel suspicious. And they're being told to trust their gut, right? And essentially what you're doing is you're saying, tap into your bias, no matter how conscious or unconscious that bias may be, and report anything you think might be suspicious. So if you're, you know, a non-Muslim who has no idea really about some of your Muslim students, and you think, oh, that child, you know, they've turned 13, 14, you know, they're now asking me if they can take a break so they can go and pray. You know, you might think, oh, that's a bit extreme. Why are you going to use your break time to pray? Why wouldn't you want to go and play with your friends? You know, and tap into that bias and think, yeah, that's a bit bizarre, actually. You know what? I'm just going to trust my gut. They've started to wear hijab, or, you know, they've started to dress more modestly. I'm going to trust my gut. This is what I am mandated to do. Bear in mind, they are mandated to do that. They have a legal duty to report those signs. And, you know, if it's nothing, I'd rather be safe than sorry. What they don't realize is that if it's nothing, what you haven't stopped is that person being vetted and interrogated potentially by a Prevent officer. And, you know, we call them Prevent officer, but really a Prevent officer is a counterterrorism officer.
Right.
So it's not even your local police officer. It's a counterterrorism officer. And most people would be quite intimidated if they were questioned even by a police officer, let alone if they're questioned by a counterterrorism officer who thinks that you might be susceptible to being a terrorist. I mean, that's a really intimidating thing to go through. So if you think about it, 5 million public sector workers are reporting on thousands of people every single year. And these people, all the first stage of a Prevent referral is that you get vetted by a counterterrorism officer. And usually that happens in person. And many times it happens at home. So it's, you know, that whole idea of like, oh, I'd rather be safe than sorry, and there's no harm done. There is harm done, even just at that first initial interaction. That's without any of the subsequent potential steps that may occur.
And what are the subsequent steps? Imagine if the Prevent officer feels that there's something here that needs to be explored further. I mean, this is, of course, what you've described as a pre-criminal space. So we're not talking about someone who's, you know, who's immediately in the process of undertaking an act of terrorism. We're talking about someone who's showing signs that they believe are signs of radicalization. So if, for example, that prevent officer decided that there's something here, what happens next?
Yeah, most times the prevent officer does believe there's something there, because you have to keep in mind that the prevent officer is trained on the same signs that the teacher or the doctor has been taught, right? Okay. So they're going on the same assumptions. And so usually they will refer it. Now, in the case of children, social services are almost inevitably always involved when it comes to a child. So whenever there is a prevent referral of a child, you have social services, even if that family was never known to social services before, even if there were no flags around any emotional or welfare, physical, any type of concerns being flagged in terms of the home, social services will end up being involved. So now you have a family who have a social services record, even though there's no signs that that child needs any support under social services, but social services will come in. And one of the reasons why social services will come in is because you don't have to engage with a prevent officer.
Right.
Even at that early stage, you don't have to engage with them.
Right.
You've not committed any crime. They're coming in essentially for a quote unquote chat. You don't need to engage with them. But you do have to engage with social services.
Right.
And so oftentimes what will happen is prevent officers won't even show up by themselves in the first instance. They will straight away show up with social services. And that creates even bigger intimidation and fear. And you think, oh my God, I have to show that there is nothing here. So the family will open that door and allow for themselves to be assessed, thinking, well, you know, I have nothing to hide. I have nothing to hide. Not realizing that the social worker is coming in with an assumption. That assumption is that your child is at risk of radicalization. And that assumption is that that child got that risk of radicalization from somewhere. And the likelihood is that somewhere is their family, their parents. Right? Because you are an adult, and therefore if your child is saying something, surely that child got that from you, right? It's that environment that they're growing up in. They're not going to say, oh, they got it from school, they got it from BBC News. They're not going to suggest that it was mainstream media or your school that you might have learned various ideas from. They're going to assume it's from family. So you have social services intervention. You have a situation where essentially you are being interrogated by a counterterrorism officer, and you don't have any of the safeguards that you would have if you were being questioned for suspicion of a crime by a police officer. You don't have those rights because the officer at the time isn't governed by the same code of conduct that they would if they were there investigating a crime. Right. And we've seen this in practice. We've complained. Clients have come to us, asked for support. They don't understand why their 8-year-old, their 10-year-old, their 13-year-old has been questioned by themselves without a guardian, without consent or anything. And they've said, hold on, this breaches PACE. Right. PACE is the code of conduct that police should adhere to.
Yes.
And when we complained to the police and said, why did you decide to question this child by themselves for 30 minutes, 1 hour, without a parent or guardian present? They've said, well, we weren't investigating a crime. And so we didn't need to follow that code of conduct. However, if you think about it, the information that they gather from that particular interrogation could be used against you. But you don't have that right. You don't have that right to silence. You don't have that right for asking for a lawyer. You don't even have that right as a child to ask for your parent to be in the room. So it's a very kind of gray area that's really open to abuse. And, you know, the social services intervention could mean that the prevent officer goes away, but the social services decide to stay.
Right.
And say, well, actually, we're going to stay and we think you need support. And then the parents feel obliged, like, oh, maybe we have to take on the support, because if we don't take on the support, then it means that, you know, we're not doing what's in the best interest of our child, even though even the social services intervention, you know, if they don't meet the threshold, they don't meet the threshold. It's voluntary. And again, so it's just a lot of social services won't explain to the parents that what you're about to undertake is voluntary. And so they think they have to engage with those social services. They think they have to engage with those prevent officers. And it can be a really, really traumatic and confusing time for the parents and the children involved, because they believe something's wrong, like something's happened. I've done something as a child. I've done something wrong, and it has created this huge intervention in my family life.
I'm looking at your report here, and it's an amazing review, actually, of Prevent, and some really interesting case studies, which I you know, shocked me. And, you know, I've been following this from afar for some time, but some of the case studies have been pretty startling. And in your report, there's an even more startling series of statistics. Let me read it out for our listeners. It's quite a long passage, but I think it's quite important. And I want you to reflect on what it suggests. So in the year 2017-18, there were 7,318 prevent referrals, of which 42% were judged to require no action. Another 40% left the process and were directed to other services. So as you've described, they're probably social services or other community services. But these were not at risk of radicalization. So another 40% were taken out of the system because it was deemed that they weren't on this so-called continuum towards radicalization. Before a channel discussion took place. So I'm going to ask you what a channel discussion is in a second, but let me just read on. So 70% of those discussed at channel did not proceed onto the program. So in all, 394 individuals out of a total of 7,318 were judged appropriate for channel. So this represents 5% of all those formally referred to prevent. So 95%, in other words, of prevent referrals were made incorrectly. And channel was deemed inappropriate for 6,924 individuals. I mean, that just sounds shocking to me. How do you square what looks like an obvious failed policy here?
So this is the beauty of prevent's own failures, that even by its own admission and statistics, you can see that it's not working. And I'd say even deeper than the 95%, because you could kind of say, well, look, if we have 100 people and 95 people haven't done anything and don't warrant any further action, then surely it's in the best interest of everybody that those five people captured from the 100 people, you know, those five people could do some serious damage. That assumes that the 5%, those five people that have gone onto channel, are actually five people who are potential terrorists, okay? Which is not the case. Right. Because channel is essentially what the governments frame it as, their de-radicalization program.
Right.
Channel is essentially, you get a mentor. So for one child, for example, the channel mentor, he was actually referred under far-right extremism.
Right.
But strangely enough, during his referral, he converted to Islam.
Right.
And his channel mentor was a Muslim who came to teach him the correct way of being a Muslim.
Mm.
You know, because there's a good Muslim, a bad Muslim, right? So he was teaching him how to be a good Muslim. Mm-hmm. And it was very bizarre. So, okay, explain to me. So this child was referred on the far right, and even the far right referral was a complete joke. I mean, people think, oh, it's fine because there are also far right extremists who are being caught. If you look at the far right referrals, they're equally damning as the referrals of young Muslims. I mean, most of these referrals are children who have said or done something that could easily be dealt with by their teacher, by their parents. And instead, they're being treated as if they're about to be the next, high profile terrorist.
Right.
So the channel mentor, the channel program is essentially like having a kind of big brother, you know, it's like a big brother mentorship.
Mm.
Okay. Again, there's no evidence to suggest that that person spending some time with them has taken them away from the path of terrorism.
Mm.
Okay. So that 5% is not even 5% of people who are genuinely radicalized and who are, you know, genuinely going on to commit any potential criminal act. Mm. In fact, a lot of that 5% are people who feel that they have to accept channel, like they have to go onto the channel program because there is a lot of pressure. And we often get people calling us saying, look, they're suggesting that my child go onto channel. These are the circumstances of the prevent referral. Obviously, the prevent referral is all ridiculous, but I'm really worried because what happens if I don't engage with channel?
Mm.
And so they feel coerced and they feel that they have to engage. Yeah. So this isn't suggesting that even that five, yeah, which is a ridiculous number in a way, but you can kind of come around and say, well, no, you know, one terrorist would be bad enough, let alone five. Mm-hmm. If out of every 100 we're stopping five, that's not the case. There's actually no evidence to suggest that Prevent does what it says on the tin. And what does Prevent say on the tin? It says Prevent is there to stop people being drawn into terrorism. There's not a single shred of evidence that has been produced by anybody in the pro-prevent lobby, by any member of government, or by any of the reviews including this Shawcross review, will not show us a single shred of evidence, I can be certain of that, that Prevent works to stop people from being drawn into terrorism.
It begs the question, why continue with such a policy? And if only 394 individuals out of a total of 7,318 are referred to Prevent, and as you've quite rightly described there, even those individuals were probably not on this pathway to terrorism, to radicalization. You know, surely the government produced these statistics. I mean, you know, they know what's going on. They know that there are large numbers of people who are being scooped up by this program who are not actually, you know, who shouldn't be referred to this program. So why continue spending millions of pounds and exerting energy and writing reviews when the program is failing? I mean, what's your thinking behind that?
I think the best way to look at that is to flip it on its head and look at the higher percentage that are not seen as, even under by their own logic, warranting any further action. So let's look at the 95%. Where do they end up?
Yeah.
Okay, so some of them are complete misinformed referrals, right? Mm. Then it's not suggested that they require any support. If you look again at the Home Office's own statistics, they're suggesting that the majority of that percent, what happens to them is that they require some support, but it's not, you know, channel. So what is that support? Well, that support is potentially healthcare support or social services support. So what has happened to the support services then? Why couldn't they have accessed mental health care or social services directly?
Right.
Why, instead of the teacher making a Prevent referral and being encouraged to make a Prevent referral, or the doctor making a Prevent referral, you know, and being encouraged to make a Prevent referral, why did they not just directly make a referral to one of the other services? Because, you know, if you go to your GP and you require mental health support,
yes,
your GP knows exactly what he needs to do that, you know. Teachers, if they think, oh, there's a breakdown somewhere in family structure or something's happening and you might actually benefit from some early year support, some social services support, they have the professional judgment, and they've been doing so for a very long time, in order to make that call, right? And to offer it as a support service to the family. But they're not doing that. Instead, it's having to go through Prevent in order to go back to social services, or go through Prevent in order to go back to mental health care. And so you have to look at the state of mental health care, and look at the state of social services, and look at the state of, you know, youth clubs even, right? What has happened to them in the last decade? Funding has been stripped from these places.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They have had massive fund cuts. At the same time, Prevent has received huge injections of money. It's easier to justify an injection of money to, you know, keep the nation safe than it is to suggest that, you know, we need money to keep our youth off the street, or to engage youth, and to, you know, bolster the mental health of our nation. And that is essentially what is happening. Prevent is being seen as this fix all, and it's not at all. In fact, it's creating more problems. And so you have people like, you know, even Sarah Khan, for example, speaking of hateful extremism. You know, firstly, nobody defined what extremism was, okay? And everyone was waiting for the Commission of Counter-Extremism to define what extremism was, because that was her role for a couple of years.
Yes.
And instead of doing that, she came out with a new term, right? I'm not going to define extremism. Instead, I'm going to come out with a new term called hateful extremism. Well, what is hateful extremism? It looks a lot to me like hateful extremism is a hate crime. We already have a definition for that. Yes. We already have laws for that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, do you think that Prevent is aimed at doing something greater? I mean, going beyond the 95%. I mean, I speak to people in the community who talk about Prevent in hushed tones, and they can see there's a palpable fear. Maybe fear is a too strong a word. Well, maybe it isn't. You know, there is a fear about Prevent in the wider Muslim community. Even beyond those who have directly interacted with the process. I mean, is Prevent there to instill fear and suspicion in the Muslim community? I mean, does it have a wider aim of I don't know, social engineering, a way to silence Muslim voices and to prevent Muslims from participating in, you know, as ready members of of a Muslim community?
I think that is one aspect of it. If we look at it from a power perspective, I mean, in order for power to thrive and to be very kind of authoritarian, you need to divide, which Prevent certainly does. You know, there is a division. There is a division amongst the Muslim community who, you know, some Muslims accepted Prevent and thought, yes, you know, there is a problem. We need to solve it. We need this money. We need to show our youth how to be good Muslims and to behave a certain way. And, you know, so there is certainly that division within the Muslim community. We've seen that play out over the years, you know. But there is also division in wider society. So you have that, you know, it plays on that far right, you know, Islamist type divide, you know, it plays on non-Muslim, Muslim, you know, it plays on that divide. And that divide is really important if you want to deliberately create division in order to remain in power and in order to be more authoritarian. It certainly silences, and we've seen evidence of that. We know that people are self-censoring, particularly the Muslim community, because they do feel targeted. So they're self-censoring. They're not displaying, you know, normative Islamic beliefs openly, because they are worried that if you are openly Muslim, then you will also be openly extreme, according to the minds of those who implement Prevent. And Prevent is not just, you know, Prevent is wider than just a referral system. Prevent, there is an environment of Prevent. There is a logic to Prevent that creates a certain environment that goes well beyond the referrals. You don't need to be referred to Prevent in order to be impacted by its logic.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So that logic, again, if you think about how people are trained on the logic, how many millions of people are trained on logic, how many people are afraid of the logic, right? You are impacted by it. You're impacted by this idea that having certain thoughts and beliefs, expressing your ideas, is going to be detrimental to you. And so you will self-censor. And so you may look at your children and say, you know what, actually, don't wear hijab just yet. You're quite young. Maybe wait a little bit longer, because I don't want to be seen as an extreme parent. I don't want to be seen as a parent that is, you know, quote unquote, forcing you to do anything. Right. So there is a worry from parents, from children. I mean, we even saw with the Palestinian activism that happened right. last year off the back of Sheikh Jarrah. You know, there were children who were acting in solidarity with Palestine who were being sanctioned by schools. Right? They were being sanctioned by schools. And so you might think, well, yeah, but it wasn't Prevent. But they were being sanctioned off the back of Prevent rhetoric and logic. Okay. And actually, there is evidence to suggest that the schools were being fed lines from counter-extremism. Right. So there were ways on how to deal with the children that were being fed down through to the schools. Right. So why were they being involved? You know, surely if the kids are doing something unruly and they're not displaying the acts of solidarity properly, and maybe, I don't know, I think there were excuses like, oh, you're not allowed to stick up things on the wall, and so that's why you're being sanctioned. Okay, fine. Why do you need the input of counter-extremism? Your school just say we can't stick things on the walls. But there were extreme sanctions playing out because of the fact that these children were expressing themselves, and, you know, Palestinian activism is on the training slides for when people are being trained up on how to prevent signs of extremism. You know, Palestinian activism is there. And we had a teacher who, I believe we included her testimony in the People's Review of Prevent, who was saying that she was taking part, you know, as a member of staff at school, she was taking part in this Prevent training. And the person who was delivering the Prevent training from the local authority said that, you know, if somebody is at a Palestinian rally, right, showing support for Palestine, if you're at a rally and you're taking your children, that is a problem. That is a potential sign of extremism. Right? So when actually that member of staff called her out on it and said, oh my God, what are you saying? And then followed up and wrote a letter, she tried to justify what she was saying. Okay, in her email, which was completely different to what had happened according to the member of staff in the actual room where they were being trained. She tried to kind of justify in the email, oh, this is why I explained it, and I didn't really say this, and this is what I said. But then what she said was, oh, you know, it's really important that we have your views, and maybe you should be part of our group so you can help us deliver this training better. And I say that in that tone because, you know,
allowing for Muslims to come into that space and feel that they're contributing is very much a part of how Prevent manages to keep itself going, right? You use members of its own community to dish out the oppression. And I'll give you an example. I went to one of the social services interventions that was playing out on one family off the back of a Prevent referral. And the sister asked me to attend with her. So I went. I wasn't allowed to speak. I was only allowed to sit and offer kind of support for the parent. And there were several people in the room from the different schools that the children went to. She had several children. And there was only one Muslim there. Okay, there were about five people in the room, all of them non-Muslim, and there was one Muslim there. And all of them spoke so highly of the children, no concerns, no issues. And bearing in mind, this sister has to go through this process in order to tick all these boxes so that she can come out of this social services intervention with her children. And, you know, the children are fine. And these are outstanding children. Like, they will put any children to shame, honestly. Like, the grades are impeccable. They're in, you know, involved in all these extracurricular activities, you know, absolutely shining stars. And then the one Muslim person who was in the room made a comment. Said, well, yeah, I don't really have any concerns, but the child did say this, and I'm just wondering where they got this from. Obviously, I can't go into the detail, but it was a non-issue. It was a non-comment. And you could see quite clearly that she was saying that because she didn't want to seem sympathetic as the only Muslim in the room to the Muslim who is essentially, like, you know, under the intervention. Okay, overcompensating for her Muslimness as a professional to not seem that she was being biased by making this ridiculous comment in the first place. That's what it came across as to me. And it's like, okay, now you're part of this whole system, and the non-Muslims in the room are using their professional judgment, right, to suggest that these children have no concerns. And you are now going above and beyond your professional judgment because you feel somehow insecure of the fact that you are Muslim and you're trying to now overcompensate and be part of this whole oppressive issue that's happening and playing out.
And do you feel, I mean, Prevent has an insidious effect on the broader, the non-Muslims and how they view Muslims? So I can imagine lots of teachers, I mean, my colleagues, after a series of Prevent training sessions, you know, were you can tell that they were far more suspicious of Muslim children and would view them with an extra level of scrutiny than, say, they would view sort of a broader student community. In fact, I remember after at one Prevent training, a colleague of mine who was a washed out liberal, a very, you know, open-minded person, after an intense Prevent training, he left the lecture theatre and said to, you know, generally that, you know, we should invade their countries and change these people's mindsets. And it was a shocking comment to hear from someone who I regarded as being sort of this left-leaning individual who's got very cosmopolitan sensitivities. And I can imagine, writ large, that there is a broader consensus growing in the broader community that we should see Muslims and their family units with an air of suspicion. I mean, have you seen that in your engagements with Prevent?
Yeah, so I think this is the... I mean, there are two ways I've seen this. Firstly, I've seen this in people who have come openly to contact Prevent Watch and say, look, I've just undergone the training and, like, oh my God, even as a non-Muslim, like, I feel really insulted by what was just being said. And then we see it in the play out of various Prevent referrals. So, you know, there was a nursery teacher, for example, who made a comment. Sorry, she didn't make a comment. She was reporting on the comment that the child made. Where the child said, you know, Allah created everything. Okay, Muslim child, of course he believes Allah created everything, right? Allah even created snow, right? Okay. So this is a young nursery age child. Allah created snow, right. Allah created everything. And then the child mentions this dua that their parent taught them Again, to a non-Muslim, non-Arabic speaking person, this is, he's uttering some Arabic words. Oh my God, you know, shock, horror. We have to be worried. But at the time, it's interesting because the teacher didn't flag it as a concern. Here, they noted it, as nursery teachers do usually, you know, when the child's playing, role playing, whatever, they'll make their little notes as part of their, you know, development. They'll make these notes. But she did not flag it as a concern. When she did flag it as a concern was after prevent officers who were unable to interact with the father, because the father refused to engage. He was like, why should I engage with you? Like, who are you? Am I legally met? Do I need to speak to you? If you want to speak to me, that's fine. Call me over to the station and I will come to the station. I'll come to the police station with a lawyer and I'll speak to you. But I'm not going to speak to you as a counterterrorism officer, you know, off the record. I don't want to do that. So that was his choice to make. And then what happened was the prevent officers approached the school of this young child who said Allah created everything and created snow, and said to that school, and this was very unofficial, there's no like paper trail, they didn't send the school letter, they turned up at the school, right? And they said to the head teacher, you know, are there any concerns about this child? And of course, instantly this planted a seed in that head teacher and in all of the teachers' mind about this child, because why would counterterrorism officers, you know, this can't be a usual event that counterterrorism officers turn up at a school and ask if there's a concern with a 4 or 5 year old. That's not the norm. Okay, so instantly what are you going to think? You're going to think there must be trouble at home, right? Because this family is involved with counterterrorism, and so, you know, there's no smoke without fire. Let's look back now and look through the comments that this child has made. And initially, actually, the teacher said, when they were first asked, the teacher said, no, we don't know of any comments, okay? And they went away. The next day, the teacher then followed up with an email and said, this is of potential concern. And they noted this particular incident where the child was saying, you know, Allah created everything, Allah created snow. My mom taught me this Arabic prayer, dua. And they said, you know, this could be of concern. And they shared that. Now, even if you thought that counterterrorism officers were involved in this child's family's life for whatever reason, even if you thought that was the case, why would the fact that this child says Allah creates everything, including snow, and the fact that this child knew Arabic dua, why would that be potential concern for you to email it through? Because now you have a seed in your mind that these people are a problem, right? And Arabic is a problem. And Islam is a problem. And even the idea that, you know, Allah created everything, for this child to think that is a problem. And I think when people, not just out of the training, but just the general environment, feel that, despite statistics, you could tell them, look, statistically, it's not correct. Statistically, Muslims are not the problem. Okay. You can show them the statistics and say, look, all the evidence shows it's not Muslims that are doing all the terror acts. It's the far right. But you can show them those statistics. It's not as strong as that sense that they feel from what they're being fed day in, day out by media, by politicians, right? It's not as strong. Showing them a statistic is not going to move them in the same way that they have been moved every single day in all the subtle signs, you know, whether that's you're on the tube and it's a, you know, see it, say it, sort it, or you're in your prevent training. All of these things build up and you don't even realize till you get to the point and you think, no, I'm not racist. No, I'm not Islamophobic. No, you are. You just don't realize the journey that you've been on. You don't realize that the person being groomed is you. You're the one that's been groomed into believing. You're the one that's been brainwashed into believing this, right? Not the problem of brainwashing isn't happening on the other side. It's happened to you.
I mean, I wonder whether that is, I don't know if we can call it an intentional, you know, one of the aims of prevent, if we were to attach a nefarious, you know, motive to this project, you know, is one such aim to regard the Muslim community as the other and to establish a certainty in the broader community that Muslims should be suspected and you know, terrorism is developing and breeding in mosques and within wider Muslim circles.
I mean, even as you ask me that question, I realize that my response to you is going to be very much my opinion, right? And as a Muslim,
in this space, I know that even me giving my opinion will be used against me, right? Because if I say, yeah, I do believe that. I do believe that is deliberate, right? Then it's like, oh, conspiracy theorist, you know, all sorts. I have reported on evidence, and in the report, the report is actually drawn upon almost 600 testimonies of people's lived experience. And these aren't just people who have called up and said, this has happened. These are people who we've gone through that journey with them. We've seen the subject access requests. We've seen the referral forms. We've seen why people referred to channel based off of the channel forms that they themselves filled out. We've seen the emails back and forth between the prevent officers. This is all evidence-based, and we've drawn upon the testimonies, and we've given examples of some of the themes that came out. We drew upon the government's own evidence, right? We drew upon other NGOs and other researchers who produced reports, and we put that all together in a, like, what, 150-page or so report? And you know, we have the UN Special Rapporteur providing supporting statement for it. That UN Special Rapporteur is not any Special Rapporteur. She is the UN Rapporteur for the Protection of Freedoms whilst countering terrorism.
Right.
You know, so she's very aware of countering terrorism and very critical of PREVENT. And yet, despite the fact that I've used evidence, evidence-based approach, and only, you know, we've not littered this report with our opinion, despite that, I was still attacked as being what? Islamist. Right? Now, what is Islamist? What's the word Islamist? Let's play a word game. Combine the word Islam and terrorist. What word do you get? Islamist, right? So Islamist is just a way that you can accuse somebody of being a terrorist, which is a real and serious crime, okay? Punishable, you know, punishable in this country with quite a few years, you know, it's not on the lower end. You're able to say that flippantly, like you're able to say, oh, these Islamists are doing X, Y, and Z. You won't be done for libel or defamation because, you know, you've not actually called me a terrorist, but in a way you have. You know, you can get David Cameron supporting a policy exchange report and saying that people who criticize PREVENT, even though that criticism is not based on opinion, that criticism is based on hard evidence, right? You can then be called an enabler of terrorism by a former prime minister, David Cameron. That's what you can be called. And so when you ask, you know, is PREVENT something that is used to silence Muslims or used deliberately to discriminate against Muslims? My personal opinion is 100% yes, based off what I've seen, based on what I feel even myself as a Muslim, as a Muslim, as a Muslim mother, as a Muslim woman working in this space, as an activist, like that's what I feel. But even when I say what is based off of pure opinion without what I feel and what is based on pure evidence without what I feel, any type of opinion, I'm shot down by it. So imagine those who don't have the evidence to back them up and just speak about issues. I mean, even in today's report on Sarah Khan talks about, you know, people who are hiding behind the label of Islamophobia. And what they're really hiding is their extremist tendencies. Really? So if you say that you are a victim of Islamophobia, what you're doing really is you're a secret extremist. There is no Islamophobia. And what she's doing is she's reinforcing the idea that Islamophobia does not exist. Because let's face it, UK government has not accepted that Islamophobia exists. So how can you deal with something that is Islamophobic? How can you deal with a policy that is Islamophobic if you haven't even addressed the fact that Islamophobia exists? If you're still in denial of it.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about the UK government strategy, Ben. They appointed William Shawcross, formerly from the Policy Exchange and the Henry Jackson Society, as its chair of its review of the PREVENT strategy. Can you explain who William Shawcross is? And he's quite, I suppose, the quite nefarious role of some of these think tanks and how they feed into the policy process at the moment.
William Shawcross is somebody who I'm actually surprised would be given the task of producing any kind of report, because he is very much based on opinion. He has been somebody who has supported every single war on terror policy by UK government. He's never shown an opinion that goes against it. So to suggest that he is somehow independent or will be working independent of government to produce any kind of report based on any type of evidence is actually quite shocking in and of itself.
you know, he's made comments about Islam and about Muslims that are clearly Islamophobic. And this is, you know, these are open comments. These are open to public scrutiny. He's not said them behind closed doors. These aren't accusations. He's been very open about it. He was the director of the Charity Commission, or chair of the Charity Commission, at a time when the Charity Commission very disproportionately was targeting Muslim charities. Okay. He was the director of the Henry Jackson Society, which is known for his Islamophobic stance and perpetuating the Islamophobia industry. If you look at all the people who are involved in Henry Jackson Society, actually many of them then go on to work at Policy Exchange. And strangely enough, guess who was also involved as a fellow at Policy Exchange? William Shawcross, who came out with a report post the People's Review of Prevent, when we did our People's Review of Prevent, who came out with a report to suggest that, you know, our report was just a small minority of Islamists trying to undermine government strategy. It was Policy Exchange. So, you know, they obviously are defending Shawcross, and Shawcross is somebody who, you know, after 3 years has not been able to produce an independent review. To be fair, he was only appointed, you know, after Lord Carlisle had to step down, but even Lord Carlisle was an independent. So in 3 years, the government hasn't been able to produce a report, even though they've tried twice to appoint a not so independent reviewer. And now I think recent reports, just the other day, there were some leaks coming out in the Mail, or I'm not sure which paper was carrying it. I think it was the Mail, saying that, you know, we can't publish this report because the lefty lawyers at the Home Office are rejecting it. It's like you're even turning against your own lawyers because they don't want to adopt whatever it is that's coming out in this report, which gives an indication that this review is a complete shambles because you can't even get it past your own government. You can't even get it past the Home Office. And you have to ask what they're trying to get past. Why are the lawyers stopping this report from coming out? And the idea is that the only reason that the lawyers are involved isn't due to libel. They're trying to suggest, oh, you know, they might be done for libel. No, they're not going to be done for libel. The only reason why lawyers are involved is because they are likely to be trying to pass legislation, all right, so or statutory requirements at some level, that's going to change the way Prevent works. So in the same way that 2015, you know, Prevent went from being a policy to being a duty, it was mandated. I believe that this time around, there will be changes on the legislative level when it comes to Prevent. And potentially it could be that interaction with Channel. So at the moment, Channel is voluntary. You know, you can choose whether or not to go onto it. But I think from the leaks and from some of the stories warming us up, I think yesterday there was a BBC report on a far-right extremist, and it said, you know, he was referred to Channel but he didn't engage with it or something like that. And I just thought, this is warming up for what is going to come out next, which is, you know, Channel will be mandatory. And if you think about it, just because somebody's been referred to Channel, it doesn't mean that A, they should have to do it, because remember, they still haven't committed any crime or even suspected of preparing or intending to do a crime. How can you force, you know, even if it's helpful for them, Even if Channel was a form of therapy, you cannot force somebody into therapy. It's no longer therapy, right? So how can you force somebody to get support? It's no longer support. But this is the pre-crime space. Prevent is in the pre-crime space. So what are you going to treat them as? You're going to treat them as criminals then, even though they haven't gone on to commit any kind of crime, nor can you ever prove that they intended to do a crime. But you want to treat them as criminals in the pre-crime space.
So my understanding is that Shawcross has submitted his report, as you've said, and the government lawyers are trawling through the report and trying to work out whether it's it can stand, you know, as you've said, it can be legitimately published for the reasons that you've suggested or others. And in the intervening period, there have been a number of leaks from the report. I mean, one such leak, which came out in The Guardian, suggested that Shawcross is arguing that right-wing, the emphasis that has been given to right-wing extremism over the last few years should be lessened, should be de-emphasized, and the focus should come back on Muslims. I'm sure you would argue the focus has never really left the Muslim community, but he's arguing for more of an intense focus on Muslim so-called radicalization. And in that leak, there was a discussion about the the idea space that leads to right-wing terror. And I think the argument was that there is not a clear link between right-wing ideas and right-wing terror. But at the same time, he's arguing that we should tackle all of the so-called narratives, the conservative and so-called radical narratives that may lead to terrorism within the Muslim community. I mean, there is a contradiction there when it comes to treating right-wing terrorism and Muslim, so-called Muslim radicalization. Can you comment on that?
So, yeah, I agree. Obviously, for us, far-right extremism, that focus on far-right extremism, it only really came into play after various criticisms and concerns about the initial focus of Prevent, which was always towards the Muslim community, right? Mm. So it was towards the Muslim community, concerns were raised that it was discriminatory. So then after one of the reviews, they said, look, we're going to focus on all forms of extremism and threw in, far-right extremism and various other activist groups into the mix as well. This is a complete red herring, not only because of the way in which far-right extremists are treated when they go through a Prevent referral and the way in which, basically the way, the kind of sanctions and the ideas and the ways they're treated is very different to how people who are Muslim who are being referred to Prevent are treated. Not only that, but also it's not unusual that Shawcross is asking for us to revert back to focusing on Muslims and go away from far-right extremists. And he even admits it essentially as part of that league. He says, no, far-right extremism, we're at danger of capturing mainstream ideas with far-right extremism. Why would you say that unless you know that actually now what is mainstream and who determines mainstream other than government of the day, right? What is mainstream is far-right, right? Far-right is a new mainstream. It's a similar phenomenon to what we saw with Trump. I'm not surprised that he would want the focus away from far-right extremism, because I think that government at the moment know if they are capturing far-right extremists, if they are capturing these ideas, then they will also capture themselves. These people, when you have people in government who are pushing far-right ideas, of course government is not going to want to focus on far-right extremism because it is going to be too exposing. With the way in which Islamophobia has been running in this country, this idea of refocusing on Muslims, he says it openly. It's unapologetic. It's very overt. And the truth is, we've got to a point now in the UK where Islamophobia is more overt. Okay, people might look at France and the UK and be very, very thankful that the UK is very far away from France. But how far away are we from France, where it's very openly Islamophobic? We're not that far away. I'm sure France didn't wake up in the state that it is in today. I'm sure it was a gradual creep. And I think the UK is on that gradual creep. There are more ideas about far-right extremists. And, a lot of Muslims think, particularly Muslims, I would say, think it's okay that Prevent exists because, far-right extremism is being tackled. But we don't want equal oppression, right? Prevent is very oppressive in the way it operates. We don't want equal oppression. It doesn't work. Full stop. So why would we want something that doesn't work to occur in a different community? It doesn't make any sense. Why would we want something that is harmful to one community to be extended to another community?
Now, notwithstanding all that you've said, it would be remiss of me not to talk about the challenge that does exist within our community. The murder of David Amos MP was by someone who was motivated, sadly, by his Islamic beliefs. At least that's what we've been told. And I understand he was referred to Prevent. I suppose what I'm asking is, in your ideal world, I mean, would you replace Prevent with something else? And what form would that intervention take?
I mean, the fact that he was referred to Prevent, and the fact that I think we have a list, we didn't actually include it in the People's Review of Prevent, but we do have a separate list of about 13 known terror convicts, right? Mm-hmm. Who were referred to Prevent, right? He still went on to commit the crime. Isn't Prevent supposed to stop people from doing that? Why is it that these people, having been referred or known by Prevent, did not get stopped? This is further evidence of the fact that Prevent doesn't work. Okay, right. So there is plenty of legislation that exists. There are plenty of tools in the toolkit that can be used to try and divert people away from crime, and also to punish people once they have committed a crime. When people say, well, okay, you want to remove prevent, what would you replace it with? Why would you need to replace prevent? We're essentially saying that prevent doesn't stop terrorism. So you're saying, what would you replace it with to not stop terrorism? I don't know, what do you want me to say? I mean, prevent doesn't stop terrorism. I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't stop terrorism. I'm just saying prevent doesn't. I don't have answers as to what would. I don't have the resources that government has. I don't know what the solution is, but I can definitely tell when something isn't working and when all the evidence points that it's not working. I'm well entitled to say, by the way, here's the evidence, it's not working. And that's all that we're doing. And I think this flip of like, okay, what should we do? You know, taking it on as our responsibility as citizens, like it's my responsibility in order to come up with a plan to stop X, Y, Z, is part of the problem. Because it's like, well, you can either put up or shut up. You know, if you don't have a solution to end something, and we're never going to be able to stop all crimes. You know, can we stop all murders? No. Can we stop all pedophiles? No. Can we stop all violent abusers? No. You know, are we going to be able to stop every terror act? Of course not. But there are other arms of the counterterrorism strategy, and there are other things that could be done. If you're talking about, you know, strengthening communities, go for it. Strengthen communities if that's the root of a problem. If you're talking about better education and awareness, go for it. There are always going to be people who pervert certain ideas. They can pervert ideas, whether those ideas are religious or not. And it can come under any single religion. It doesn't just have to be Islam. And so this idea that, you know, the Muslim community need to take responsibility for somebody who uses a religious idea and perverts it for their own cause is actually part of that wide aspect of like, it's your problem, you have to deal with it, and you have to be impacted by it. And if you're impacted by it and you're discriminated against it, well, tough. You know, and nobody else will take that responsibility. No other community is expected to take that responsibility for every single member who claims to be part of their religion or group or thought process. Like nobody else has to do that.
Dr. Leila Talhaj, thank you for your time today. And if any of our listeners wants to find out more about your organization, how would they access your material?
So the People's Review of Prevent has a separate website. So it's peoplesreviewofprevent.org. And the Prevent Watch, if people specifically have an issue regarding Prevent or want information about that or support with regards to Prevent referral, then you can go to preventwatch.org.
Jazakallah khair. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.